Welcome to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein. As the number of college students wanting to pursue a career in public service is declining over the country, Joelle Hannum, a junior at North Dakota State University, is bucking the trend. She's received the prestigious Obama Chesky Voyager Scholarship for Public Service, which is awarded to only 100 rising college juniors across the country who plan to pursue a career in public service. Joelle, welcome to Main Street.
Well, thank you for having me.
Take me back to your high school time. You're not from North Dakota. You're from Alabama.
That's correct.
Tell me about your high school days.
Yeah, so from elementary school, I planned on becoming an architect, so a lot of my decisions focused around that. So once I started high school, I was homeschooled, and so during the morning, I did core subjects, and in the afternoon, I was either taking drafting and design courses at the community college, or I had internships either with the City of Montgomery Planning Department or with House to House.
So then it came a time for you to decide what you wanted to do after high school. What happened next?
Yeah, so after working with House to House, I wanted to...
And what is House to House?
It is a nonprofit focused on affordable housing and mentorship. So it works in some of the poorest communities in Montgomery. And really the idea behind it is salvaging properties that a lot of people say should be torn down in the same way that all lives can be salvaged as well. So all life and property has value.
Did you meet with community members to try to devise plans to save those properties and those folks?
So I really did more work on site, so more construction work. And I was also in the office designing plans for the houses that were being renovated.
So you were kind of working as an architect, a draftsperson, doing those things, which was still the time that was your career plan?
Yes, it was.
Somehow, some way, you ended up in North Dakota from Alabama. What happened next?
I was looking for a bridge between high school and going into architecture. So I served with AmeriCorps through Twin Cities Habitat for Humanity. And once I was finishing up, I started looking for a school that would fit architecture. And NDSU is a good fit for architecture because they have a 5-year master's.
Your time with Habitat for Humanity, what was that like compared to what you were doing in Alabama?
In a sense, it was similar but also different because I was working on new construction, and in Alabama, it was old construction.
How were you whetting your appetite for maybe a desire to change course later?
I was on site, so helping build the houses and leading volunteers because that's the labor part of Habitat. So I had a little interaction with the homeowners who would come later on, but a lot was just interacting with volunteers.
Then you came to NDSU, still planning on a degree in architecture. Things have kind of went another course.
Yeah, so something I really enjoyed about architecture is it has many dimensions. And one of those is how individuals interact with their buildings and how it impacts their mental health. So I started becoming more interested in the mental health factor, along with being in this mental health crisis of not having enough providers and needing providers who are more competent with dealing with a wider range of people from different cultures.
So how has that changed then your coursework?
Yeah, so I'm now studying psychology and sociology just because I have this increasing interest like within mental health, but also knowing that individuals are impacted by their surroundings, the social part of individuals.
Let's talk about the scholarship that you've received. Only 100 up-and-coming juniors across the country have received the scholarship. First, how did you learn about scholarship?
Yeah, my dad came across it on Scholarship America, and he encouraged me to apply for it.
This was a scholarship, though, of public service. Had you already started maybe thinking that this was the course that you were going to take?
Yeah, so public service has always kind of been in my mindset because I think it's more of an attitude for life instead of necessarily a career. So even when I was looking at architecture, I still wanted to be involved in some form of service, so design buildings that would help people more. And so now it's still a very important piece of what I want to do is being able to serve individuals and the communities.
So you have this wonderful scholarship that also has a $10,000 stipend to go on what's called a summer voyage. What is that?
It's an opportunity to travel, to intern, basically do whatever I want to do. And I'm not quite sure what I want to do. Part of the programming that the Obama Foundation has, which is who is funding the scholarship, is developing what I want the summer voyage to be.
Can it be anywhere in the country or anywhere in the world?
It can be anywhere in the world. As cool as I think it would be to go to like around the world and next summer, I think I'll just visit a couple of communities and really connect with the community members there.
Let me ask you this. You had a public service vision as part of this process. You said you plan to focus on the intersection of mental health, community wellness, and the built environment. What are the challenges or issues that you see in the public service sector that you really want to attack?
One thing that I'm passionate about is access to mental health services and health services. I think specifically within Black and Brown communities, there's a lot of stereotyping and stigmatizing around accessing care, specifically for mental health. And I want individuals to know it's okay to seek care and it doesn't make them inherently broken. In the same way we seek care for like a broken arm, we should seek care when we're not feeling okay in our minds as well. I'm also interested in how like sleep is impacting mental and physical health because they're related, and if sleep improves, then mental health and physical health both improve as well.
One of the things I think that I've noticed in looking at this issue too over time is that rural areas have, it seems to me, little access to mental health. Have you come across that being out here in North Dakota versus, say, what's available to folks in urban areas?
Yeah, so Fargo has a lot more providers than in the rest of North Dakota. I think one piece that's really changed is telehealth services, and that's increasing access to individuals being able to access at least mental health services. With mental health, a lot of it is just talking, and if it's been slightly adjusted, then that can be done very well over telehealth. But if the doctor like needs to like feel your hands or whatever, like that can't be done over like a video.
You've talked about what a built community is. What is that? And you've talked about the mental health aspects of a positive, supportive community. What else is involved in what's called a built community?
So it's what we're modifying to fit our needs. So like the earth is just like oceans, forest, mountains, but humans don't really interact with that. We interact, and what we have is cities, which are massive design elements. And that's like modification to fit our needs. So from buildings to streets to light poles, everything has been modified so that we can function better. And so I'm always interested in kind of like how that is impacting like our interactions as individuals, like with other people and then with ourselves.
So what pops into my mind then is what I've heard as urban planners. Is that similar or is that more specialized?
It's similar, and it's also specialized within the sense of they're designing more cityscape versus like an individual building. So projecting how they want the city to grow or to be developed, which then impacts what buildings are built, how streets are designed.
What would you like your peers to know about public service? At the top of the show, we talked about maybe fewer and fewer people, and especially fewer people your age, are looking at lives of public service. What would you tell your peers?
I don't think public service has to be this big career. Our like idea, like your whole life has to focus on it. I think it's about finding what interests you, because that's is going to be what is sustainable. So for me, like part of that was building houses for a couple of years, but not everyone likes to do that. And therefore, I don't think they should be. But if they have something within their field like financing that they're really good and love doing, then they can find somewhere else they can also pour into their community in that sense.
I think that our nation is more divisive than it may have been years and years ago. Perhaps others have a different opinion about that. Does that concern you as you go forward as a young, soon-to-be graduate wanting to have impact on communities?
I think it will always impact us, because what's always above us within being divisive impacts the individual. But it also means as I'm interacting with individuals, I can help them thrive within whatever circumstances we are in. And so in a sense, that doesn't change if we're divisive or if we're thriving together. There will always be a part of interacting with individuals and helping them to do as well as they can.
When you look out into the future, what are the challenges in your mind that are in front of you?
I think within the public service field, burnout is a really big problem, because people go in with this idea that they have to be gung-ho, do it all the time, have this lifestyle of, oh, I have to be serving all the time. And then they fail to prioritize their own needs, their mental health, physical health, like their sleep, which impacts both of those. And I think part of what I'm interested in sleep can really help with that, because it's teaching the community members, including public service members, that it's okay to prioritize yourself and to take the time that you need, because you need to have a glass, as we often talk about, like being able to pour out, but you need to have a glass. And if it's smashed, like, you can't pour out anything. You have to completely focus on yourself. So if you want to continue to pour into other people, you first have to put yourself first.
I think many people, at least it's been my observation, have different perceptions of what community engagement means and what it's all about. What does community engagement mean to you?
I think it's involvement and listening to the community. It's not coming into the community and telling them what they need, because when individuals or organizations do that, it doesn't go well. The community doesn't feel heard. But if individuals or organizations come into the community and they stake themselves out, they live in the community, they're engaged in it, they're making the active decisions and choices to interact with their neighbor, then they know what the community needs. And once the community says what they need, then that can start to be addressed. And it goes a lot farther than just telling people what they need. So it's this active decision-making, active choices. It's not a passive thing that you do on this side.
I think I've just thought about, oftentimes, I think many people would feel, okay, we've got a city council, that we elect them to worry about that stuff. We don't need to be a participant because they'll take care of it. Is that the wrong way to think?
In a sense, because you need different perspectives to create a community and to serve the public. So, like, city council only has so many people on it, but the community has huge amounts more of people, and somehow that needs to be addressed. And individuals, if they're just doing one or two things that can make someone's life easier or bring joy, then together as a whole, then we're helping our community thrive more.
I was thinking before I came over, if you were in this role, say 40 years ago, your ability to communicate immediately with many would be very limited because of technology. Technology has changed so much. Is technology going to be an asset for you working forward, or is it going to be another hurdle?
I think it's going to be an asset because it will allow, like, dispersion of materials and interventions to go out a lot faster. Like we were talking about telehealth earlier, it's making, like, access to care easier, and eventually we'll have some form of ways that individuals can work through with, like, themselves, like on self-guided modules to access care, which lessens the burden on providers as well and reduces costs of treatments.
Any mentors or heroes in the public service sector that you've thought about and maybe have learned from?
Yeah, so I gained a lot of mentorship from Dr. Dugan Odalis, who I work with in the lab. And I'm also connected through the Obama Foundation to a huge network of the alumni who've gone through there, who are professionals in public service.
Joelle, tell me the volunteer work that you're still doing today as a student.
So the lab that I'm working with does community outreach, which is part of the mission of NDSU being a land-grant university, is increasing scientific knowledge. So the lab often goes to farmers market, and this summer we went to a block party in a rural community.
Where did you go?
It was Pelican Rapids, Minnesota.
What'd you learn?
In a sense, it's handing out materials and increasing the public knowledge on sleep and heart health and bite-sized pieces that individuals can take and, like, implement in their own lives.
Let me ask you this question. When you go home for break or for summer, if you've had a chance to, what do you tell your parents about the fact that you kind of shifted gears from being an architect to where you're going now?
In a sense, they saw the shift. They saw as, like, one of the reasons I shifted was I was struggling with my mental health more. And so they saw my interest in mental health increasing, and my passion for increasing access to care and helping individuals have that. And so when I started talking about switching to psychology and sociology, they kind of saw that as, like, okay, that's a natural pathway. And one of my parents majored in sociology, so he was also excited that, in a sense, I was taking on, like, what he loved as well.
We are enjoying our conversation with Joelle Hannum, a North Dakota State University junior who won the Obama Chesky Voyager Scholarship, which is a collaboration between the Obama Foundation and Airbnb co-founder Brian Chesky. The scholarship aims to support students pursuing a career in public service. Joelle, you recently had a chance to travel to Chicago to network with other winners. What did you take away from that experience?
I took away the feeling of, like, not being alone within, like, the public service realm and wanting to go into it, because it's becoming just less and less, as we've discussed previously. Meeting other, like, young individuals who are just as passionate and specifically like within mental health, is just really encouraging to see, and it encourages me to continue to grow into the field.
You had a chance to hear probably several folks talk, including the former president, President Obama. What did he say?
One thing that I took away that was most interesting to me is how he basically approached his presidency of trying to cross like polarization and the divide by just listening. So hearing what everyone has to say first and then saying what he has to say. So he was becoming like the biggest listener, but that provided him to have a very successful presidency in a sense and a very successful public servant.
Who else spoke that you got to listen to?
One mental health professional spoke, and I just found kind of her outlook to mental health interesting, and the fact that she didn't look at it in like a negative fashion. She looked at it almost like in a humorous way of like anxiety being like a little sassy. And so it wasn't like the negative stereotype that mental health can often get.
What did you discover, Joelle, about yourself during that trip when you got to see so many other great students like yourself?
I was able, in a sense, to discover that I could be present in the way that I could be, but also like hold open hands and just letting like the experience wash over me instead of like trying to grab pieces at it, which is great because that allowed me to just be present more than other experiences that I've had where I am just trying to grab pieces and instead kind of miss the whole thing. But what I was able to grasp was so much better. I also was able to really figure out that I do enjoy travel and exploring, but connecting with people is also really great.
Has this changed at all the focus of your future studies or of your Voyager scholarship travel opportunities?
I think it more confirms that I want to look more into sleep and understand more like what good nights of sleep look like, because there's so many individuals who struggle with sleep, from like the young people in my cohort to those who want who they want to help. And so understanding sleep would really just be a great way to help others.
I'm going to ask you one final question, Joelle. Are you more optimistic or less optimistic about your future having interacted now with these wonderful people?
I'm more optimistic in the sense, like, I know it's going to be hard, but there's just like this great network of like young people within my cohort, but also within the Obama Foundation that are really rooting for me to really succeed and to be a public servant.
We also would like to visit with some of Joelle's faculty who have been working with her, including Dr. Kat Dugan, who is an assistant professor and the director of the Personality and Trajectories to Health and Sleep Lab in the Department of Psychology at North Dakota State University, and Odalis Garcia, a graduate student in psychology at North Dakota State University. Dr. Dugan, let me begin with you. How do you envision Joelle's skills that you've observed and her education that you're providing as contributing to the public good?
I first met Joelle class a little over a year ago, and at the time it was obvious that she was bright and creative and excellent at bringing together groups of information that wouldn't necessarily talk to each other, but she made them talk to each other in really exciting and compelling ways. And that's how I see her role in public service and in public health and in science, especially in sleep. There's a lot of myths and inaccurate information in the public about sleep and what healthy sleep looks like. Most Americans don't know much about sleep, but sleep problems are common. They're disproportionately experienced by people from low-income backgrounds and other vulnerable populations. And we need people like Joelle, people who have the bona fide sleep training, who know how to do science, and who actually care deeply about these groups, to interface with them and talk to them about how to sleep better and be healthier. So I see her as kind of a sleep equity ambassador, and I think science and these communities are really lucky to have her. There's been decades of research showing that different dimensions of sleep, whether we're talking about how long you sleep, whether you feel rested, the timing of your sleep, whether you're waking up frequently at night or having sleep complaints, all of those different elements of sleep feed into not only physical health, but mental health as well. Depending on the mental health condition, sometimes sleep complaints are part of the diagnosis of that condition. Other times, complaints about sleep tend to go along with the experience of distress and acute mental health episodes. Some of the most exciting research, in my opinion, that's come out in the last 5-10 years is actually showing that sleep symptoms oftentimes precede mental health episodes. So that suggests from a public health perspective, if you want to help people feel better, you need to start by addressing their sleep rather than ignoring it or talking about it sort of at the end of a clinical encounter or at the end of a clinical treatment.
Well, Dallas, you're a graduate student here at the university. Yes. What's your interaction with Joelle?
With Joelle, just kind of broadly in the lab, I work a lot with research assistants helping build their scientific practice and literacy. And specifically with Joelle, it's been a little bit more in depth working on building her own program of research. And it's been exciting to see somebody be so passionate about topics that are so important. And I think her passion coupled with her unique experiences is something so valuable to science that we need more of. So it's exciting to see something like this scholarship.
As an educator, what does it mean to be a mentor to someone like Joelle?
It means I have a lot of fun, honestly. I really enjoy it. I'm really lucky, and she's brilliant. She's creative. So rather than imposing what I think the need of science might be, I try to give Joelle the space to figure out what she thinks is needed in science and the kind of project she's interested in pursuing. And then I try to give her the support needed to actually do that work in a scientifically rigorous way, where it can also be used to help people. So we have a lot of fun doing good science, and I get to sit back and do the funnest parts and watch her and Joelle, her and Odalis, grow in their skills.
You see yourself in that role?
I feel similar. I'm growing into it. I have a lot of learning of my own to do, but it's very nice to be at a place where there are things that I do know and even things that some people don't always know you need to do. A lot of people refer to as like the hidden curriculum of graduate school and things, higher education in general. That's something that I'm slowly uncovering myself. So that's something that I want to do for others as well.
What does it mean to you that one of your students has been this successful and now recognized nationally with this scholarship that she has won?
It's a dream come true, because when I say she's brilliant, that is an understatement. That's the understatement of the year. And I think that science in these communities need folks exactly like Joelle, and to be able to give her this platform, the financial support so that she can develop these interests, financial support to actually go out into communities and talk to these community members about what does good sleep look like for you and what do you need to sleep better, rather than us over in our ivory or brick towers or whatever imposing our structure of what we think that needs to look like. That's extraordinary. And it's the kind of stuff that I would think is impossible. Like, oh, if only we had X. But we actually have it in the awarding of this scholarship to Joelle. So it's extraordinary. And it's one of the best things, I think, that has happened to an undergraduate in my lab in the 15 years or so that I've been mentoring them.
Congratulations. Dr. Kat Dugan and also Odalis Garcia, both in the Department of Psychology at North Dakota State University, thank you for joining us. More Main Streets ahead. Stay with us.
Lots of listeners have complimented Ashley Thornburg's interviewing skills over the years, and so have plenty of her guests.
Hi, my name is Bonnie Sommerfeld. I'm from Fargo, North Dakota, originally Valley City, North Dakota. I love all things Main Street. I'm a total fan. And when I come in to be interviewed by Ashley, it's so wonderful. I'm asked questions that are poignant, and I learn things about myself by answering the questions that I did not even know I had or that existed. So I just always look forward to it, and I hope everybody else does too.
If you appreciate thoughtful questions and hosts that take the time to listen, then step up and support Main Street and all the things you enjoy on Prairie Public with a gift of financial support. Just go to prairiepublic.org and open the red link that says donate.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg, and birds. There's just something about their hopeful sound in the morning that, at least if you're like me, just brings a little bit of joy to your heart. And I know I'm not alone. Birding is an exceptionally popular hobby among many people across the world, and entire vacations often planned around looking at birds. But more than just something to look at, they are important as what's known as an indicator species. They let us know the health of the ecosystem, and we're going to learn a lot more about birds and an upcoming fundraiser to support birds, and specifically the show Bird Note, that is coming up. It's online on November 30th. That is at 5 o'clock Central that day. And we are visiting now with Executive Director of Bird Note, Nick Bayard. Thanks so much for joining us today.
So happy to be here. Thanks for having me.
And we also have a Development Director, Jessica France. Thank you for joining us today.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
All right. This event is called the Ultimate Bird Drawing Throwdown Showdown and Online Auction! Exclamation point. So I think you're a little bit excited about this. I want to hear from both of you, but Nick, why don't you go ahead and start? What is a Bird Drawing Throwdown Showdown?
Well, it has something for everyone, and it is kind of just what it sounds like. We're lucky we're going to be joined by renowned bird illustrator David Sibley. So if you've ever seen a North American bird guide or used one, you've likely seen David's drawings. He really is one of the preeminent bird illustrators alive today, and he's going to be going head to head against the star of Bob's Burgers and Archer. You might also know him as the can of vegetables from Wet Hot American Summer.
Oh, I forgot about that.
H. John Benjamin, and they're going to actually be challenging each other to draw birds, and you can watch them actually in real time, be in the room with them as they, go head to head in this sort of, there's really nothing like this been tried before that I'm aware of.
Okay, Jessica, walk us through, how did this combination of people and events come together?
Great question. I think it probably goes without saying, David's pretty renowned and well-known. As Nick said, if you've picked up or used a bird ID book or field guide, you've likely seen his drawings. And Nick, I don't want to overstep here, but I know that John Benjamin is a friend of your family. So we were very lucky, very fortuitous to have this relationship come together. And as we've been working with John and David to sort of put this event together, it has been really hilarious and really funny. They're obviously both really smart, really quick. But the event itself is going to be a once-in-a-lifetime thing that you can't miss. It's going to be a lot of fun.
What makes someone, Jessica, a good bird illustrator?
Oh, goodness gracious. I guess it depends on who you ask. I mean, if you can probably identify what it is, then that's probably a good thing. I think what will make this event in particular very unique is that obviously David is very talented as an illustrator, artist, scientifically accurate and whatnot. And H. John Benjamin is not an artist. However, he is a comedian, so he's very funny. So I think there's going to be a lot of very interesting trash talking and probably some interesting sketches to come out of this as well.
Well, Nick, how can people participate in this?
Well, you can go to birdnote.org, BIRDNOTE.org, and right on the front page there, it'll tell you how to sign up. And also want to mention that we're going to have a musical guest, Andrew Bird, who's a virtuoso violinist, and he contributed to the Audubon Society's Birdsong Project last year with an original piece called Rare Birds. So he's got a love of birds, and I don't think it has anything to do with his last name. That's a coincidence.
He's very aptly named.
Yeah, it's right on the nose. So we're excited to have him. And also want to mention, too, that John Benjamin became a bit of an internet sensation in the birding community during the pandemic. He started something called Morning Bird Report, and he would go on Twitter and do like a minute or two of his birding. And it was always very funny.
Right. He has a way of getting attacked by birds that nobody else does.
Yeah, so it's a really interesting combination of people, and should be a lot of fun. And in between the bird drawing battles, we're going to be featuring items from our online auction, which are phenomenal. We've got tours and trips and airplane rides and artwork and the opportunity to sponsor your very own Bird Note Daily episode. So a lot of opportunity for people to get involved and get something out of it. And at the end, people can actually bid on the drawings that these guys create, which will be great.
Oh, that's just going to be so wonderful. And again, this fundraiser is coming up on Thursday, November 30th. It happens at 5 p.m. Central. Author and illustrator and renowned at those is David Sibley, off against H. John Benjamin of Bob's Burgers and Archer fame. And you can find out more about the event at birdnote.org. Nick, I want to ask you a little bit about how Bird Note itself is going.
Sure, thank you. So we are really pleased to share that over the last year, our radio audience has grown by about 1 million people. We've had three or four really big stations pick us up as a daily show. And I'm not sure if a lot of your listeners know this, but we're an independent nonprofit, which is why we're hosting this fundraiser. Is that we rely on listener support. And so part of the reason we're encouraging people to come to this auction is it's our main fundraiser for the year and allows us to continue telling the stories that people love every day. It takes a lot to create the stories. There's writing, editing, fact-checking. We have a science advisory council we work with. We have to source the sounds. We have to do sound engineering and distribution and make sure that stations are aware of us. So there's a lot that goes into it. And I think we have a really, really strong, powerful team. And so it's a big part of my job is to make sure that we can continue to support them and grow what we do. Because there's really nothing like Bird Note that I know of, something that is sort of the entry point to environmental conservation for people. We are focused on inspiring people to care about birds and nature in the first place, so that they can take steps in their own lives to protect them. And there are lots of organizations where, once you already have that love, you can go and get involved. But this is unique because it gets people to start to pay attention in the first place.
Yeah, why are birds so important to pay attention to? There, I mentioned in the beginning, there's something called an indicator species. Nick, what does that mean?
Well, that means that it gives us sort of a barometer on the health of an ecosystem. And so take, a pretty staggering fact is that over the last 50 years, we've lost about a third of North American birds, huge declines over just 50 years. So if you're my age or a little bit older, that's during your lifetime. And one thing I want to make sure that we're really mindful of is that when every new generation is born, they kind of look around and see nature and kind of assume that that is the baseline. When in fact that represents what's been lost over generation to generation. That's something called generational amnesia, where if we're not telling stories of how things used to be and how much loss we've actually had, there's not going to be as much of a sense of urgency to do something about it. So what we try to do is balance that sort of dire situation and the truth of climate change and habitat loss with joy and hope, and using that as the primary driver for action.
Because
that's what actually gets people to care and sustainably act versus if it's just gloom and doom all the time.
Yeah, people respond a little bit better to that which makes them happy, right?
Yes.
Jessica, as the development director here, I'm listening to Nick's answer and hearing him talk about you need to get that messaging of this is important and we need to pay attention and act now in responsible ways with couching that sort of in the sugar here of the comedy aspect here. But talk to us a little bit about how you do have to tailor the messaging at times so that people do understand the seriousness of this.
Thank you for that. You actually mentioned it earlier. You know, birding is a special thing. And one thing that I think all of us on the BirdNote team really personally resonate with and that has come through in the BirdNote mission in our almost 19 years of making the show is that you could do it everywhere and it's sort of a great unifier. You know, anybody walking through the grocery store parking lot or you're on your way to work or you're in your apartment looking out at the, you know, the parking lot or whatever, everybody has a bird story. We kind of laughed about it earlier with somebody getting, you know, having their bird attacks. But it's amazing. Every time we meet someone, everybody has their bird story, their owl encounter or their who's in their bird feeder this week. Mm-hmm. It's really a great unifier. And to the conversation that was happening earlier about the power of positivity and the joy and wonder of nature, just sort of a curiosity and a lust for life, is really a psychologically a greater motivator than doom and gloom and sadness and sort of that feeling of impotence that can come. So BirdNote has been very effective in getting people to care and to sort of recognize their love for the natural world. And that's what we're hoping to do both with this event and with the shows on a daily basis is just really get people to see themselves in that and then hopefully take action and pass that on too.
Yeah, Jessica, Nick also mentioned earlier that there's been an increase in 1 million listeners. You've been busy. That kind of growth doesn't just happen. Without getting too inside baseball here on how shows are developed and fundraised around, let's talk about the fact that 1 million listener boost means that you're really onto something here. And how do you scale that?
Mm-hmm. We'd like to think so. And Nick, I don't want to take over here. You chime in as well. But coming through the pandemic, you know, people really got interested in nature. You know, the bird seed suppliers, the bird house builders, all these sort of adjacent industries really skyrocketed. Mm-hmm. And I think in a lot of ways, BirdNote has become even more appealing because it is a respite from regular news and the daily grind of politics reporting and sort of things like that. Not that those things aren't important, but it also gives people kind of a chance to step back, become more in your body, get more aware of what's going on around you, and then keep moving forward.
Yeah.
Well, what strikes me is that everywhere I go, when people find out I work for BirdNote, they exclaim, "Oh my gosh, I love BirdNote so much." And I was just at the PTA meeting the other night and had the same reaction. It's really like nothing else I've ever been part of. It's oftentimes so unexpected, you know, when you're hearing the news, all of a sudden theme song might come on and then you're immersed in the lives of birds. You know, expectedly or unexpectedly. Mm-hmm. And either way, I think people really get something out of it. I remember the first time I heard it, the world kind of stopped. It's like, this is not only a great idea, but just, you know, it kept me wanting more. Mm-hmm. And so that, you know, the power of the original idea has really borne out. And that's why it just, you know, it continues to grow.
What is the significance of the Prairie Pothole region, which is North Dakota, is part of that region? Specific to birds, why is this area important?
It's a major migratory pathway, and it's a pathway that, in particular, I know Ducks Unlimited has been very focused on because of the importance for waterfowl. Also, some of the great global crane migrations happen through that area. And there are organizations. We just did a partnership last year with the Nebraska Crane Trust, where you can get online and actually watch it real time. I think it's something like 1 million cranes passing through at a certain time. And this is really important. The divide between duck hunters and birders is often not as wide as you would think. Oftentimes, there are very much shared interests between those groups, and they're invested in the same outcome. So, you know, a lot of the best conservation work that's happened over the last 100 years, especially through that area, has been through hunting. Hunters have to buy duck stamps, and a lot of what they have to buy to hunt contributes money to government programs that directly support conservation for those corridors. So I think it's a really interesting opportunity for more partnership to happen between those two groups.
Has Bird Note weighed in on this concept, this movement of bird names for birds? A lot of times they are given these honorifics. They're named after people who we are now understanding have very troublesome pasts. I'm thinking even of the Audubon Society, not a bird, of course, but named after someone who, you know, we now recognize for the way that he treated enslaved peoples. And there is concern about continuing to name birds and sort of referring to that as a verbal statue. Does Bird Note have an official position?
Yes, thanks for asking. We are very supportive of the bird names for birds movement. And if you go to birdnote.org, you can find our podcast, Bring Birds Back. And there's an episode called What's in a Name? And it goes into depth on a lot of those problematic names that have been given to birds based on, you know, someone who committed genocide or enslaved people. And it you know, it's an unnecessary barrier for particularly for people of color to enter this space. But it's also just it doesn't help people identify the bird either.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
And just a few years ago when we made that episode, the American Ornithological Society, which is charged with actually deciding names of birds, was pretty much resistant to the idea of changing any of these bird names. And they talk about that in the episode. And just about, I think, a month ago, they announced that they'd made a complete 180, and they're basically going to take away all the honorific names and replace them with more descriptive names, which is just wonderful news on a lot of different levels.
Jessica, do you have either a favorite bird or a bird moment?
Oh, goodness. I got to narrow it down now. I think my favorite bird is the keel-billed toucan, something that was kind of passed down to me from my dad, who did a trip to Costa Rica when I was young, and sort of kind of a magical place in my mind. And I had the privilege of traveling with some Bird Note fans to Panama last spring and got to see the keel-billed toucan in real life, you know, in my personal experience with it. So those flying bananas, they called them there. So that was really meaningful to me.
Nick?
Gosh, you know, I had a barred owl land on my the ledge right outside my window the other day, which was really bizarre. I'm always on the lookout for sort of unexpected things in nature, and you know, birds are always offering that in different ways. I guess just in terms of personal experience, I enjoy nature's extremes as well, the hummingbirds and the cassowaries.
That is Bird Note Executive Director Nick Byard. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having us.
We've also been visiting with Bird Note Development Director Jessica France. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having us, and we hope to see everybody at the event coming up on November 30th.
And again, that is happening at 5 o'clock Central. You can register for the event at birdnote.org. It promises to be a very fun time featuring comedian and actor H. John Benjamin and David Sibley and musician Andrew Bird. And now we'll have an episode of Bird Note.
This is Bird Note. Over the years, we've heard from lots of listeners about our thousands of episodes. Like, my cat loves listening, and I do too. And, a delightful start to each morning, like a robin spring song. And listeners are always curious about the origin of Bird Note's theme song. Around the time Bird Note became an independent nonprofit in the mid-2000s, Chris Peterson, Bird Note's founder, invited Grammy Award-winning artist Nancy Rumble to work on the short but memorable theme. Rumble used high-pitched wind instruments to mimic the sound of birds. After sketching a few melodies on the oboe, she threw in the wooden ocarina to add sweet bird-like chirps. Rumble says she created a dance-like marimba pattern to ensure it'd be catchy and playful. Following some additional tweaks and suggestions from our senior producer John Kessler, plus a smokin' bass line, the theme was birthed and history was chirped. Bird Note is an independent nonprofit funded by our audience, and this week we're asking for your support at birdnote.org. Bird Note has brought a love of birds and nature for over 18 years, and none of it would be possible without donations from our loyal listeners. Keep Bird Note going strong by donating at birdnote.org. Thank you.
This is Dakota Datebook for November 21st. Thanksgiving is this week. Today, we take a glimpse at the holiday from long ago. In 1891, the Thanksgiving menu of the Headquarters Hotel in Fargo took up 2 pages and included such dishes as Blue Point oysters, frog legs, sweetbreads, and wild game like venison, quail, and duck. In 1901, the Northwest Hotel in Bismarck, among its many items, offered such interesting fare as green sea turtle, caviar on toast, black cub bear with currant jelly, and a possum, Southern style. In November of 1902, the owner of the Hunter Herald newspaper offered a $5 reward after a thief stole the fat Thanksgiving turkey from his coop. It was the second turkey stolen from him in 2 weeks. Storms aren't uncommon on Thanksgiving in North Dakota. In 1896, 2 men were caught in a bad snowstorm as they traveled from Monango to the Maricourt area. They found shelter in an abandoned shack where they stayed for 3 days. They found chickens at a barn nearby and roasted the meat over a fire on the floor of the shack. In 1928, the town of Buffalo went without electricity from Thanksgiving until almost Christmas after a days-long storm of freezing rain collapsed telephone and power lines. People burned coal and wood for warmth. In 1935, the Partial Congregational Church held a special Thanksgiving service after paying off the debt on its parsonage. The service included a worship with the refrain, "We burn the mortgage." Thanksgiving in many communities in North Dakota coincided with happy events like weddings and church openings. In 1885, a Medora area couple had a lot to be thankful for with the birth of a baby boy who weighed a whopping 13.5 pounds. Today's Dakota Datebook is written by Jack Dura. I'm Merrill Pipcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
That's it for this Tuesday edition of Main Street. Coming up tomorrow on the show, in the season of thankfulness and of giving, we learn about the Ronald McDonald House Charities and the work that they do helping families undergoing medical crises. That's coming up tomorrow on Main Street. Until then, enjoy the rest of your day.